This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good afternoon. Can people hear me okay if I keep the mask on? Can you hear me online? Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining today at our tea time without tea. These are, of course, very strange times. I've of course given talks here in the Zendo before, and I've given talks online before. I've actually not done both at the same time before, so it's a little strange to see both all of you and this screen. For those of you joining us remotely, I guess you can see from the other camera, we have 9 of us all together here in the Zendo, so not a bad number. And I can see there's more of you joining us from afar. I'm going to talk a little bit about lineage, and I thought I would start by just reading a very small part of the Denko Ruko, the Transmission of the Light, which is one of the foundational texts of our Soto Zen tradition, written by Kaizen, who's often considered our second founder after Dogen. I'll just read a couple of paragraphs. Shakyamuni left his palace one night when he was 19 years old and shaved off his hair. After that, he spent 6 years practicing ascetic exercises. Subsequently, he sat on an indestructible seat, so immobile that there were cobwebs in his brows, a bird's nest on his head, and reeds growing up through his mat. Thus he sat for 6 years. In his 30th year, on the eligibility day of the 12th month, he was suddenly enlightened when the morning star appeared. He said, "I and all beings on earth together attain enlightenment at the same time." His first lion's roar. After that, he spent 49 years helping others by teaching, never staying in seclusion. With just one robe and one bowl, he lacked nothing. He taught at over 360 assemblies, and then finally entrusted the treasury of the Eye of Truth to Kasyapa, and its transmission has continued to the present. Indeed, this is the root of the transmission and practice of the true teaching in India, China, and Japan. If you've been practicing Zen for a while, you probably know that we take this lineage very seriously. And if you've only practiced Zen and not practiced other Buddhist traditions, this probably feels very natural. And it might surprise you that other Buddhist traditions don't see lineage in the same way. For us, caring about lineage feels like an essential part of practice, of paying respect to our teachers, caring about the origins and the authenticity of our teachings. So it may surprise you to know that if you ask the teacher in some other branch in the Buddhist family about their lineage, they may not understand exactly what you mean. They would, of course, know the sect or school where they studied, and they might know, of course, would know the name of their own teacher, but beyond that, they might draw a blank. Most other Buddhist traditions don't talk about lineage the way we do. In our tradition, every priest receives a piece of paper that gives every teacher from themselves all the way back to the Buddha. If you're ordained today, it's a fairly long list. I think in my original ordination papers, I think there's 85 teachers between me and the historical Buddha. different priests in America will have a somewhat different number, but all pretty close to that. And it's important because this is really what traces the mind-to-mind transmission from us all the way back to Buddha. The passage I just read explains that first transmission from Buddha to his student, Mahakasyapa. And he then passed it to his student, and so forth, all the way down to us. If you look at it the other way, the legitimacy of our teachers is basically based on the legitimacy of their teacher. It's vouchsafed by that teacher, who was then vouchsafed by that teacher, again, all the way back. So this chain of transmission, it's sort of like a chain of trust. That trust leads all the way back to Buddha. We remind ourselves of this chain when we chant the names of the ancestors, as we often do in our morning service, where we go through each of their names. Again, this seems very natural to us, but it is essentially unique to Zen. If you practice Vipassana, for example, you would know the name of your teacher, and maybe one or two generations beyond that, especially if one of those teachers was particularly famous. But it's very doubtful that you could trace a lineage all the way back to Buddha. It's just not something that's emphasized in those traditions. And sometimes even the name of your specific teacher is not seen as particularly important. If you practice in the Goenka Sangha, for example, there are now many, many teachers. Goenka has long passed, but it's still thought of as Goenka's teachings, and the exact line from whoever is teaching you back to Goenka is not something that people particularly trace. It's almost a little bit more like going to college, where you might identify with the school where you studied, but not necessarily with a specific professor, again, unless that professor happened to be particularly famous. And you certainly wouldn't be expected to know who your professor studied with and who that professor studied with, and so forth. In those traditions, it's emphasized much more what you've learned rather than who you learned it from. The root of our lineage here is Koban. And we're here this week to honor him. And Koban's view of lineage, I think, was subtle and profound. Koban was never exclusive in his teaching, and he wasn't exclusive in his view of lineage either. Lineage was not about us versus them. It was not some exclusive club that some of us might be invited to join. It's really just about paying respect to those who have helped us along the way. Mike and I were just talking yesterday, but in our morning service, we actually acknowledge four different lineages, and that came from Koban. At the end of our service, when we offer the merit of the service, we list four names that come from four different lineages of Soto Zen. We mention Shogaku Shunryu, which is Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, who was a friend, colleague, perhaps a mentor in some ways to Koban. We mention Hozan Koei, who was Chino, Koban Chino, was the transmission master who passed transmission on to Koban. And we mentioned Gyozan Kine and Tengai Bunryu, who were father and stepfather to COVID. If you look at a traditional lineage chart, those four people are far apart. But Coben felt that he should pay respects, that we should pay respects to all of them, because all of them had played an important role in his life. So even though officially in Soto Zen, you're part of one lineage, Coben knew that it was not as simple as that, that the stream has many branches, both before us and after us. And I think of this as generally something that Coben taught us, that it's important for us to preserve and remember, that the forms and traditions are important and that we should treasure them, but treasure them without grasping them, without attaching ourselves to them, and without letting them necessarily restrict us. I found Coben's lineage somewhat by accident. I met Coben late in his life, although it didn't feel late at the time, in the mid-1990s. He was a bit of a reluctant teacher by then, and some say he always was, but he was getting ready to start a new family, had a lot going on, wasn't necessarily looking for new students. And I was a bit of a Zen Center castaway. I had lived at the San Francisco Zen Center and had talked about ordaining there. But then my wife, who was at the time my girlfriend, she managed to get kicked out of City Center, which was awkward. And so I thought I should leave too. And we started a life outside the temple. And I still talk to Reb and some of the other teachers there about ordaining. But at the time, they were quite strict that you had to live at the temple to ordain as a priest there. And I had these good friends. Some of you may know Gunter and Richard, who at one point led Poreg in Austria and Felsentor in Switzerland. And they were good friends of Coben. They offered to introduce me. And I remember Gunter said in his very sweet German accent, which I won't try to reproduce, he said, "Coben will ordain you. He'll ordain anyone." And he said, "I think he keeps a drawer full of cases. I'll just take one out and ordain you." So I wrote to Coben, and he agreed to see me. At that time, he was living in Taos. And it turned out there was no drawer full of cases. But he did say yes, that he would ordain me on two conditions. The first was that I did actually have to sew my own ocaso. And that seemed reasonable. The second was that he wanted me to take responsibility for my own training. He felt that he couldn't take that responsibility at that point. So he would ordain me, but he wouldn't take responsibility for training me. At the time, that sounded reasonable too. While I was living at Zen Center, I had become friends with Blanche Hartman, mostly because I had become friends with her husband, Lou, who seemed to like me, even though he didn't like anyone. And so she said I could come to Green Gulch and sew, which again at the time was unusual. Zen Center was not as flexible as they are now about letting people sew with them. And so I went to Green Gulch every weekend for about 2 years. I was the only non-Zen Center priest sewing there then, and I sewed my ocaso. Blanche taught me for a while, and then after that, Galen took over as sewing teacher. And I really was very slow, but I got it done. And so finally, after about 2 years, I was done. And so then the question was, where's Coben? He had left Hokoji in Taos a while back and was bouncing around a bit, not answering my letters. But I found out that he was living near Santa Cruz, I think, in Hollis's place. And someone, I think, here at Jikoji gave me his address. So then I had an address of a street I had never heard of and that I couldn't find on any map that I just knew was somewhere near Santa Cruz. And so I drove to Santa Cruz. This was, of course, before things like Google Maps. I drove to Santa Cruz and found a bookstore and bought a map, found the street on the map, drove to the house. And I found the house, but I didn't find Colvin. So I left him a note saying that I'd finished sewing, was ready to ordain, gave him my phone number and address. But no call. I ended up doing that a few times. I never actually found him at home, but eventually he did call me, and we made an appointment to meet. And he started teaching me the forms of ordination. And again, the strange thing about Colvin was that he was a master of these forms. That in some ways was the reason he was here in America in the first place. When it was time to start Tassajara, the first Zen monastery in the West, Suzuki Roshi didn't really know the forms. He had not spent much time, I guess, at the big training monasteries. And so he asked Colvin to come and help establish these Zen forms here in America. So Colvin was a master of these forms, even if he often seemed unattached to them. And so he walked me through what I would have to do. And we made a date. And I was ordained right here. I think in those days, the altar was sort of back there. He was, of course, many hours late to the ordination. But it was wonderful. Nonetheless, he brought his daughter, who was very young. I remember her as a toddler, just kind of wandering around through the ceremony, letting the grown-ups do their thing without paying any attention to us at all. And he started teaching again a little bit. He would lead sesshins here sometimes, and I would go to those sesshins. And I would wear my robes, my rakusu. And I was trying to figure out how to be a priest, how to represent Colvin's lineage. And at that point, this second requirement that he placed on me, that I should take responsibility for my own training, really started to weigh on me a bit. And I thought, he can't mean it, really. He must want to offer me some more teachings. And so I do remember at one of those sesshins that I signed up for Dokusan. And told him that I, you know, would like some more advice about my practice and about living as a priest. And I remember he said, I saw you in the bathroom today. And I thought, this didn't seem like a very promising way to start. And he said, I don't think you should pee standing up. And that was it. That was his advice that day. So we had a few more interactions like that. But again, they were kind of obscure. And it did seem like he really wanted me to find my own way. Not long after that, my first daughter was born. Colvin had a few more young children. And so he was teaching less and less here. He moved to Boulder for a little while, was doing some teaching there. And I guess I was consumed with being a father, and he was consumed with that and with some of his other responsibilities. And so I didn't see him much. And then just a month, I think, after my second daughter was born, he died. I think that's 18 years ago now. And I remember that although my daughter was only like a month and a half, we had gone to the East Coast to see my parents. We're staying at sort of near the beach. And I had to go into town and find a sort of a health food store that sold incense so that I could make a little memorial for Coben. I made an altar out of stones on the beach to pay some respects. As I said, that was 18 years ago. I'm a bit over 50 now, and I've been a Buddhist for more than 30 years, a priest for 22 years. And really only a few of those I spent with Coben. But he's still my teacher, and he's still my lineage. That doesn't mean I haven't learned a lot from other teachers. I have. Like Coben himself, I can pay homage to many teachers, but he will always have a special place. And now that he's gone, in many ways, we all have to follow the path that he gave to me, of finding our own way, of training ourselves, and of preserving this lineage that he started here for us, with us. It's a big responsibility. When you read the stories of our Zen ancestors, they worked hard to practice and preserve the teachings. It's a big responsibility that falls to us. The Buddhist tradition has already lasted 2,500 years. It took many hundred to get from India to China, many hundred more from China to Japan, many hundred more from Japan to us here in the West. Now it's up to us what happens next. I've always thought our goal here at Jikoji should be to build a 500-year temple, that this, like the great temples of Japan, the great temples of China, this will be preserved for many generations of our lineage to come, and might continue to have a special place in their hearts, the way the founding temples of our ancestors' lands do. But again, whether that happens or not is entirely in our hands. Our practice is precious, but it's also fragile. It can slip away. These are, of course, immensely challenging times. Although, again, if you read the stories of our ancestors, There have been many challenging times. Temples have faced war, famine, and plagues. And it's difficult to practice in these challenging times. I do worry that some temples won't survive. But I feel confident that together, our Sangha can preserve this lineage seat here at Jokoji. The Compassion Light Temple that Kogan has left to us and that we can leave to others. This Kogan Memorial Sesshin has always been really one of my favorite times to be at Jokoji. There were a few years, many years ago, when there were fewer residents here, when I would lead a one-day sesshin for the Kogan Memorial. And I think it's special to me because, again, it's our chance to reflect on this lineage that has been brought to us, and that now is entirely on us to preserve. As I said, Kogan was a strong believer in tradition and forms, in paying respect to our ancestors. But he would also want us to continue to adapt. He was willing to change many rules himself, and he wouldn't want that tradition to end with him either. And so we have to figure out which parts to preserve, which parts to evolve. We have to figure out the best way to maintain this lineage for the next 50, 100, 500 years. And looking at all of you here in the Zendo and out in the world, it really does fill me with hope. There were so many dedicated practitioners, so many dedicated students, that together we can carry this lineage forward. And I do think if Kogan could see what we've done so far, he would be happy. Probably wouldn't say much, but he would smile. And I think he would like what we've done so far. So thank you so much for joining this strange sesshin in these strange times. But even these strange rules that we've had to adopt for the time being, even they are examples of how we are following in his footsteps, adapting, changing, and doing what we need to do to ensure that this lineage carries on for many years to come. Thank you all so much. Shall we open to questions? So you can ask a question online or also take questions in the room. There's a question in the room now.
Yeah, I just want to mention a technical thing, Dan. The microphone in front of you is the only one we have in this room. So anyone in this room that might want to talk is going to need to really project or get closer to the device.
So, okay.
So thanks for letting me step in and say that.
I can also repeat questions if they come in.
I do have a question. It seems in listening to the stories of how Zen Buddhism, moved, the genesis of it and how it's moved through various parts of the world, it seems to me the story I've heard about its arrival in the West, in the United States specifically, was that not only was it arriving in a new place, but perhaps coincidentally there was a great shift from the teachings and the practice being for monastics, for people who had knew that what they were going to do with their lives was to be at a temple for their whole life, and it's being opened up more to laypersons to integrate into householder lives. Now, I might have this all wrong, but if that were the case, it seems that there are a lot of things that are in the ancient teachings, or maybe not so ancient, that were intended for monastics, intended for people whose sole focus of their life was going to be spiritual pursuit. Did you ever run across things where you go, wow, this is one of these old things that is for people that aren't householders, who aren't raising children of their own? Or do you find ways to integrate everything that's been passed along into your modern life that has many different facets?
So I'm not going to try to repeat everything you said, even though I said I would do that. But the question involved whether one of the changes that happened when Zen came here to the West, to America, was a focus more on lay practice than on monastic practice. So I think, first of all, lay practice has been part of Buddhist practice from the very beginning. So the very first Buddhists, other than Buddha, were in fact lay people. There were two, the Pali Sutras tell the story of two, I think, traveling merchants. I think their names was Tapusa and Balika, who just happened to be visiting a village near where Buddha was practicing. And somehow, even though he had not started teaching, he had not even decided to start teaching, word had spread in the village that there was an actual enlightened person sort of just outside of town. And even though holy people were much more commonplace in ancient India, there were a lot of sort of traveling seekers then. It was still a big deal to have a fully enlightened person, right on the edge of town. And so these two traveling salesmen went to see him. And they somehow immediately realized that he was, in fact, fully awakened. And they asked to be his students and became his first two students. These days when we become Buddhists, we take the three refuges of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. There wasn't a Sangha yet, so they only took two refuges, Buddha and Dharma. And much later in Buddha's life, there's passages in the Pali Sutras where he sort of lists all of his great disciples, and he still remembered those first two people who just came, saw him, heard his teaching, and became Buddhists. And throughout Buddha's life, he taught monastics, and he taught lay people. He taught everyone from slaves to kings and queens. Mostly Buddhists thought that it was just easier to practice as a monastic, which sounds strange today because we think of living in a temple with lots of rules often as sort of a hardship. But I think what he meant is not that it's easy exactly, but that you just develop fewer attachments and that it's very hard to live in the world without developing those attachments. And so, yeah, he just thought it was easier to practice as a monastic than to practice in the householder world. But just because it's easier didn't necessarily make it better, and didn't, and certainly didn't mean it was the only path. And he had students who became fully awakened in all walks of life. But that said, it's certainly true that in Zen, in China and Japan, monastic practice began to be sort of fully refined into many of the forms that we have here. You know, if you were to go to a early Buddhist monastery, you know, like a Theravadin monastery today in Burma, it wouldn't really look very much like what we do here. But if you went to a Zen monastery or China and Japan, it wouldn't be exactly like this. I don't know if they have the big TVs, but you would see like a family resemblance. You would know what was going on. You could sort of follow along with what they were doing. But when Zen, you know, was brought to America, there obviously, like, there were no monasteries. There was no option of really bringing a monastic practice here. And so those early teachers, I mean, in a sense, there was no one to teach but lay people and no environment to teach them but the household world. At the same time, all those original teachers, sort of one way or the other, ended up starting monasteries. So Suzuki Roshi with Tatsuhara, Koban was very involved in Tatsuhara as well, lived there for several years. Izumi Roshi started a mountain monastery outside of LA and then was involved in starting Zen Mountain Monastery in upstate New York. Many of these original teachers who brought Zen from Japan to America ended up really doing both, teaching lay people, but also establishing residential practice communities and even truly monastic settings. And so I think, you know, they're both really important. I think they're very different ways of practicing. Jikoji itself is in a sort of interesting middle space between being a sort of a monastic practice and a lay practice. We are in some ways a monastic setting, but on the other hand, many of us who practice here have some householder life as well, and even many of you who reside here have some householder life outside. And so I think, yeah, we found an interesting middle ground here at Jikoji, which is really neither a lay practice nor a monastic practice, but something in between. So I don't know if I'm really answering your question. I do think practice is more firmly established here than it is in China and Japan today, although there are teachers that teach lay people there too. And that some of that, you know, is by sort of the necessity of there just not being this long tradition of monasteries. And some of it is that there just seems to be more interest in the lay community in practicing Zen while also leading a household life. I see a question online. Christopher?
Thank you. I wonder if you can say anything about the meaning of Köppen's lineage for you or for us.
Thank you. Well, I tried to talk some about that. I think it is in the very literal sense, you know, Köppen's lineage is our, is sort of the root of our authority, is what gives teachers here at Jokoji an authorization to teach. As I said, Köppen is sort of vouching for us. And so that's what distinguishes us from someone who just decides one day to start teaching meditation, or someone who trains in a different tradition and is authorized there. We are authorized by Köppen. And with that authorization, I think, comes a responsibility to try to be true to the style of Zen that he brought here. So that leads to the question of, like, so what is that style? What is it? What is it that we're trying to preserve? I do think of Köppen's teachings as very much this middle way. Of, as I said, respect for tradition and ritual, but also a willingness to adapt and do things differently. A sort of rebellious spirit, a non-hierarchical spirit. I still think in many ways people don't appreciate how strange it is that we all called him Köppen, which is just within the Soto Zen tradition in Japan. I mean, almost comically informal. The analogy I sometimes give is it would be as if Pope Francis asked you to call him Frank. It's just very odd. But that really was something he deeply felt. He wanted that level of informality. And yet at the same time, he wanted us to wear these robes and to sew rakusus and to do these things, but never to take ourselves too seriously, to show respect for these traditions without grasping them, without sort of worshiping them. And finding that middle line, that middle way, that's something I really have tried to carry from my time with Köppen. And then I think I would remiss if I didn't also mention just his great compassion, that he just cared very much for people. I think it's no accident that this is Compassion Light Temple, because I think he did see compassion as part of the light that's transmitted from teacher to student and from all of us to everyone else. And, you know, of course, it's tragic, but somehow also makes sense that Köppen himself passed away trying to save someone else. Again, fully embodying that compassionate spirit. So at least for me sitting here now, those are the things that I try to take from the lineage and try to preserve. Yes, there's another question online.
I'm trying to unmute myself. Did Coben give others of his students the same deal that he gave to you, that you would find your own training? Was that standard for him, or was that just where he was in his life at that point, that he didn't want to take on all those responsibilities?
I mean, I don't really know the answer to that. I've often thought it would be interesting to try to compile a complete lineage of Coben students, because he had many. And as I said, I was ordained somewhat late in his life, but I certainly wasn't the last one. And I don't know what sort of instruction he gave to those he ordained after me. I do think earlier he was teaching more actively. And I've sometimes heard, just sort of anecdotally, that some of the students he had, like not at Jokoji, students he had in Europe, because he used to go to Europe and lead sessions there every year, thought of him very differently. Because, you know, when he was there, he was just focused on teaching. He didn't have all these other things going on. And he was also often, you know, in the midst of a session that was very organized. So I've spoken to students who knew Coben only in Europe, who thought he was very organized and, you know, very sort of, you know, punctual, and just had a very different view of him because they just saw him in this very different context. And he certainly knew how to operate that way. Like I said, he had spent time in training monasteries. He knew how to do everything by the book, if he felt that's what he called for. So I don't know what sort of instruction he was giving other students, but I do think it changed over time and even in different places. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, I see another question online. Yes.
Somebody whose teacher was also let go from San Francisco Zen Center. But was not focused on form. What have you learned about form? The importance of form.
I am still, I'm still learning about form. I was actually just talking to Jen about this a couple days ago here at Jokoji. You know, there are people even in our tradition who really try to practice without form, who feel that, you know, the robes and the chanting and all that is something that may have been useful in other times and other places, but that there's no particular reason to preserve it here in a very different place at a very different time. No reason to wear these sort of medieval clothes and chant in languages we don't understand. And at some level, I understand that way of thinking, and I understand the appeal to that, of that, the sort of purity of some kind of pure practice. But on the other hand, I have really come to appreciate the forms. I enjoy coming up here and putting on robes and doing services, even just the simple forms of sitting, to hold our hands in a certain way, to hold our posture in a certain way. And part of it for me is that it does connect me with this lineage. I think about all the other students who have sat this way, who have chanted this way, who have worn these robes, and who have faced many of the same struggles that I face, that you face, that all of us face. And I like that connection. I like that reminder that we are not the first to face these challenges, that others have faced them before and have overcome them, have experienced awakening. So, I do value the forms, and I appreciate that Koban brought them here with him. There are other Zen traditions here in America that have largely discarded the forms, where no one wears robes or no one is ordained. And, you know, I think, I'm sure many of them have a strong practice as well. But for me, I like that our lineage has preserved the forms. At least, to my mind, it preserved just enough of the forms to connect us back to this long lineage without creating sort of a obsession around too many little details. So for me, it's a nice balance. Good question in the room.
That is the longevity of a tradition dependent on the structure of it? Do you think that monasteries tend to last longer where we're in between?
So Doug asks if the longevity of the tradition is somehow connected to the structure, like monasteries lasting longer. It's hard to know. I mean, it certainly building a structure like a temple, like a monastery, you know, it creates a physical embodiment that can then be preserved. But you know, there's strong practice in places like Thailand and Burma and Sri Lanka that don't really have the same tradition of building like big monasteries. I mean, they have temples, but I don't know if they're particularly old. They seem to sort of come and go. And, you know, that tradition has preserved, you know, even longer than the Zen tradition is. I do think it's helpful to have this, to have a seat for the traditions, a seat for the lineage, which we have here with Jikoji. And I think that's one of the reasons it's worth effort to preserve it. You know, it's not that the lineage couldn't survive as just an oral tradition from warm hand of just teachers and students. It certainly could. But I do think it's helpful to have a place where people can come, where teachers can come, where students can come, where we can practice together. So I do think the physical embodiment is very helpful. But it's of course not enough. There are lots of examples of, you know, beautiful old churches or temples or other places of worship or practice where the building is preserved, but nobody practices there anymore. It's just an architectural landmark now. So preserving the physical structure is, of course, not enough. We have to actually preserve the practice.
So in this line of continuing the practice, the Buddhists have developed extensive Vinaya, you know, the list of 250. Is that going to help us?
So, you know, I don't know. There's very lively debate in the Theravadan community where they think it's very important. And it's one of the reasons that the ordination of nuns in the Theravadan tradition is so controversial still, because it's not clear that it's technically allowed now under the letter of those rules. And while many, maybe most, think that it's sort of silly to get too hung up on those things, and so, you know, women have begun to be ordained in the Theravadan tradition again, there are still holdouts who say, you know, it's a mistake. You start making any little change and it's all going to fall apart. That only by preserving sort of the letter of the law can you be assured that the tradition will continue. I guess at least my reading of how Kobin carried himself and carried the tradition was that it was antithetical to that, that he really believed in adaptation. He brought lots of changes. He cared about the precepts and he cared about the forms, but he certainly didn't observe them obsessively. In some cases, maybe he didn't even observe them enough. But that he believed in some flexibility. And I think it served us well, and I hope it continues to.
A comment about that. I think Kobin really didn't like phony stuff. So he didn't like it when people were like really using the forms to express their ego. Mm. So I really think, and also he was an artist and very talented in such a broad range of things that he taught from this very big place of different forms, but they're subtle forms and they're forms of being rather than forms of religion. So I think that that's what Colvin's lineage is about.
Thank you. Well, maybe that's a good note to close on. Thank you so much for sharing that. Thanks again, all of you, for joining either here in person or wherever you are sheltering now. It's really been nice to spend some time with all of you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.